You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 14th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history from Princeton University, CNN contributor too, I think, Professor Julian Zelizer on burning down the House, Newt Gingrich, the fall of a speaker, the rise of a new Republican Party. Meanwhile, 5.4 million Americans have lost their private health insurance since March. The White House, with the imminent end of the federal expansion of unemployment insurance ending, White House is backing off its complete opposition to extended unemployment, but holding fast against a livable benefit. Meanwhile, as most U.S. parents fear a return to school for their kids, L.A. and San Diego say no school in the fall. California shuts down its bars and indoor dining amidst a coronavirus surge. Joe Biden to call for trillions of dollars in a total green energy conversion by 2035. Also, he says he's open to getting rid of the filibuster. It's primary day in Alabama, Texas, and Maine. Find out if those Trump-supported candidates win. 17 states sue the Trump administration over an ICE rule expelling international students. Meanwhile, in the House, Joaquin Castro announces his attempt to dislodge Dem war hawks from the Foreign Affairs Committee leadership. Tucker Carlson heads on vacay in the wake of his non-apology for having a racist incel head writer. And Trump's Treasury Department buried investigations into racist lending practices. Can you imagine? Lastly, an Obama-appointed federal judge strikes down Georgia's anti-abortion law. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Happy Tuesday, as it were, I guess, as we, we should really have done a day. We should be doing like a rolling day of our pandemic, at least in this country. Still have massive problems in many of the states across the country. It's increasing in all, but I think one or two, the infection rate, more or less. But in some areas, obviously, significantly more. Someone chastised me in the emails for saying California was surging when, in fact, it's Southern California. That may be the case. But nevertheless, California has rolled back its opening. In Texas, there are increasing reports of ICUs at capacity. Florida. Same. Of course, we all have an opportunity now to go to Disneyland. That's exciting. 5.4 million Americans have lost their private health insurance since March. A Families USA found that the estimated increase in uninsured laid-off workers over the three-month period was nearly 40% higher than the highest previous increase, which occurred during the recession of 2008 and 2009. This is interesting. In the 37 states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, 23% of laid-off workers became uninsured. Now, that number should be zero, just to be clear. The idea that that number would be acceptable is absurd and grotesque. But the percentage was nearly double that in the 13 states that did not expand Medicaid. So there is a material difference between those states that had expanded under Medicaid and those that had not. And what we should have is a single-payer healthcare system so that we wouldn't even have this conversation, among other things. But that is it. Half of the coverage losses in the pandemic came from five states: California, Texas, Florida, New York, and North Carolina. And you have those states couldn't be handling this more differently, I think. Let's move on to that question of schooling. San Diego and LA said they're not going to have any school in the fall. These are two of the biggest school districts in the country, New York City being the biggest. There's 1.3 million students, I think, who go to public schools in New York City. And here is just how, now this, listen, there is a very, very significant debate about this. There's a story in the Daily Beast today. Israel had got their cases down to like nearly zero. Not quite zero, but nearly zero in the country. They reopened their schools. They did it at first like a halfway measure, and then they went full bore. And then they had a surge, and like 40% of the new cases that they got came from schools. But there are other countries that have been able to do open their schools. They're without any without the students being vectors. Then there's that story I read from Syracuse 4 or 5 days ago. Daycare center. Mom comes in waiting for her test results. And she's infected. She doesn't know it. Kids there, kids infected. 4 or 5 other kids get infected, other adults. So very difficult to parse this out. The Fox and Friends folks managed to make it one of the dumbest debates you could possibly imagine in virtually no time. Here is here's the crew, although I guess Ainsley Earhart is on vacation with Hannity or something, so. Here's the crew.
If Denmark, Norway, Belgium, Switzerland, Greece, and Germany can do it, can America do it? Nothing's easy. We could find a way to do it, get protocols together. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, Dr. Atlas, they're all saying there's risk, but there's more of a risk keeping your kids out of school. Send them to school. Yeah, meanwhile,
but Brian, at the same time, how many politics are involved in those other countries?
I don't know.
Is it an election year?
I have no
Does
idea.
Does it have anything to do with it? Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, it's just so ridiculous to keep a kid out of school for an entire year. You have to understand, you have to have that factor in. And if politics plays a role, we'll know on November 3rd. If on November 5th, all of a sudden, L.A. finds they got to go to school if Joe Biden wins. And in Oakland, they find out all the kids got to go right away back to school shopping. We'll know politics played a role, but it'll be too late for the country.
Well, actually, even if that ridiculously stupid scenario happened, the idea that kids are going to start school 2 months later, I would take that. If it is somehow miraculously not as much of a danger to the kids, and particularly to the teachers and the staff and parents, I'd take a 2-month delay. Are you kidding? Of course. But that's the dumbest possible. The idea that this is about, there's, you know, here is, Kilmeade had the answer without even realizing it. He said, if Denmark, Norway, Belgium, Switzerland, Greece, and Germany can do it, can't America do it? And the answer is more than likely no, because there is no federal assistance to doing any of this. We can't even get people to agree on masks, for God's sakes. And largely because of their network.
I would point out that there are, in fact, politics happening in Europe this year. So
what? There are politics? That's absurd. They could vote in all these parliamentary systems. They could vote for a vote of no confidence at virtually any time. Ding, ding, ding. What a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, that ding ding comment is like something you'd expect a very dumb relative who just watches Fox News to say, not like the actual.
Exactly. Like they're no, now.
It's the first thing.
They're now like eating their own pre-digested gruel. They're actually like, it's like they're actually like spewing it out. We're not even going to give you the pre-digested one. We're going to give you the one that's pre-digested and then been digested again. It's like a cow's cud or something. And the amazing thing here is that, like, they know that the administration has been hell-bent on pretending none of this is existing. The reason why these other countries can do it to the extent that they can is because they have had a concerted response that has been intelligent and involved federal spending, and they have all of this infrastructure, and they have some sort of cohesion in their country. They don't have lunatics who think that wearing a mask is some type of freedom infringement, or that they're going to get CO2 poisoning from wearing a mask, as if they've never even seen, like, I don't know, a Dr. TV show. Like, do people really think that doctors would go through surgery if they were getting CO2 poisoning throughout the whole thing? With masks on? It's absurd. Do people not realize the basic science of that CO2 molecules are atomic in their size? They go right through a mask, as opposed to a virus, which is, you know, like, is, I don't know. I don't know the specific. Is it like 100,000 times larger, 1,000,000 times larger than a CO2? I mean, it's, you know what a CO2, molecules made of CO2, period. It's tiny. God, the level of idiocy that has brought us to this point is historic. I'm glad we have Julian on today. Maybe he can sort of like give us a view from the future. What will future historians say how dumb we were in this situation? Sorry, I'm a little riled up today. But as you know, for all our sakes, we need to avoid crowds in any way we can right now. But what if you need to go to the post office? What if you need postage, send out letters and packages? Well, I have a solution for you. Don't worry about it. Stamps.com is here to help. Stamps.com, you can print postage on demand. You do it right on your computer. Skip those lines and crowds at the post office. You can personally print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, for any package, for any class of mail, for anywhere. So if you're like me and you're awake for God knows why from like 3 to 5 every morning, well, this time it was because my kid woke me up. Go up, you print your package postage or your letter postage. Then all you do is hopefully wake up in time for the mail carrier to come. Or you just schedule a free package pickup, or you drop it in a mailbox, however you do it. You know, no human contact required. That's my favorite thing. And if you're a small business person sending invoices, if you're an online seller, like my daughter apparently selling out Depop stuff, just working from home, you need to mail stuff, Stamps.com can handle it all with ease. Stamps.com, you get great discounts too. 5 cents off a very first class stamp, up to 62% off of shipping rates. And now Stamps.com also is UPS service with up to discounts of up to 62%. You won't even have to pay UPS residential surcharges. And now listeners of this program get a special offer. It includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Majority Report. That's stamps.com. Enter the code Majority Report. Check it out. Also, this is a new product. I don't know if I've talked about this before, but I've had it and I've been using it actually for months. That didn't even occur to me. I was wondering, like, where did I get this? I'm talking about my new deodorant. I don't know if I've advertised this before. Maybe it's been a while. But longtime listeners know that I have always been very skeptical of deodorant. And because I just don't want any of that, the garbage that they put in there. I don't know if like what they say about it is true, but I'm not down with it. When I read a label of deodorant, if it's got any of that like aluminum stuff or whatever, forget it. Won't do it. Well, that's why I'm using Native deodorant. It has ingredients you've actually heard of, like coconut oil or shea butter, tapioca starch, which, to be honest with you, I had never heard of before. It's vegan. It's never tested on animals. And the best part about this is switching from an aluminum-free deodorant doesn't mean you have to sacrifice in terms of protecting yourself from smelling bad. Native keeps you smelling and feeling fresh all day. They got 10 scents. They have rotating seasonals. They got coconut and vanilla, lavender and rose. I would never, ever do, as you know. But I know people like that, but I wouldn't do it. Cucumber mint, I like that one. Citrus and herbal, to name a few. And they have unscented, which, of course, is my favorite. Native is risk-free to try. Every product comes with free shipping in the U.S., plus a 30-day return and exchange. For me, I think people know I am a almost primarily unscented person. I don't like smells that much. But coconut and the cucumber mint, I've tried it. I like them both. I will mix that up if I feel like I want to actually smell like something. But in the main, and I got the sensitive, they have one for sensitive skin. For me, I'm unscented, sensitive skin. That's just the way I am. So do what I did. Make the switch to Native today by going to nativedeo.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout. You get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/majority. Use promo code majority at checkout. Get 20% off your first order. Also, lastly, I know your routines are changing, but maybe you're not going out as much. There's never been a better time to learn something new. You got thousands of options available. Finding the best way to learn can be challenging. My recommendation, an app called Blinkist. Blinkist is unique. It's powerful. It works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser, wherever you want to take it. It has the key insights of over 3,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories, condenses them down into what they call blinks, and you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. Now Blinkist offers its members exclusive original podcasts from top authors and creative thinkers. You can also dive deeper into full-length nonfiction audiobooks at a special discounted price. Matt, over 14 million people use Blinkist to deepen their knowledge in topics spanning from self-improvement, management, happiness, and more. But there's also ones that are history. There are books that I have read. I mean, for me, I've told you this before. My strategy with Blinkist is like, are there books that I sort of feel like I should read, but I don't want to read? Or are there books that, like, I'm not really interested in the prose of in the writing style of someone who's going to tell me how to, like, be more efficient in managing my time? Those are the type of things. With all due respect to Tim Ferriss, I didn't want to read the whole book. I did the 4-hour work week and I did it as a Blinkist. But also, I read that, I didn't read it. I did the Blinkist of Everything Trump Touches Dies by Rick Wilson. I wanted to see how sincere that guy was. And I'm thinking of checking in Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, because why not? It only take me 15 minutes to either listen or read. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for everybody in our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. Start your free 7-day trial. You get 25% off. That's you get a free 7-day trial, and then they give you 25% off the Blinkist premium membership, Blinkist premium membership, and you get up to 65% off your audiobooks, which you can keep forever. Matt Leck, that's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority report to get 25% off a premium membership and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority report. As always, we will put all of those ads in our podcast description, our YouTube description. Also, I should remind you, this show is supported by our members. And if you want the show commercial free, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Princeton professor of history, Julian Zelizer, on burning down the House. Newt Gingrich, the fall of the speaker, and the rise of the new Republican Party. We'll be right back after this. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure. It is a pleasure to bring back to have back on the program the Princeton and not the I guess a but for me the Princeton professor of history on his new book Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, the Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of a New Republic of the New Republican Party. Julian Zelizer, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Great to be with you.
So, Newt Gingrich. Now, I got to say, I have the book here. I knew a little bit of Newt. I've been following his career for quite some time, obviously. And there was a lot of stuff in here I didn't realize. I want to broaden this out. I mean, this is a book really about, in many respects, about personalities. But I do ultimately want to broaden it out a little bit. But just tell us, I did not realize, and I'm really hurt by this, that I didn't realize this, that he married his own math, his high school math teacher. I knew everything else about how he ditched her when she had cancer. But tell us, give us a little bit about just like his bio. I think I had forgot that he became a congressman as early as 1978. So just give us a little bit of where he's coming from.
Yeah, this guy, he was born in Harrisburg, right outside Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, working class, conservative area. His biological dad left his mom while she was pregnant. And he grew up with his stepdad, who was in the military as an army brat. So he moved around Europe, lived in many different places until they finally settled in Georgia. And in high school, in late high school, he starts dating secretly his high school math teacher. And when he goes to Emory after high school, she goes with him and she gets a job there and they will get married. And his personal life starts in a bit of a turmoil situation. His stepfather disapproved of this. Gingrich gets a PhD in history at Tulane. He gets a job in West Georgia College, but he doesn't want to be an academic. And so he runs for Congress in 74 and 76 against an old Southern Dixiecrat, Congressman John Flint. And then finally, Flint retires. And in 1978, he wins in a pretty blistering campaign against someone named Virginia Shepherd.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about how he won that race against but let's just talk about like his impetus to become a congressman, because the thing about Gingrich is he doesn't seem to care. Like, you know, there has been some of the biggest right wing personalities, I feel, don't really seem to care that much about conservative policy in any fashion. You know, like I'm thinking like a guy like Breitbart, for instance, who there wasn't a single policy that he would advocate. He was just, it was all for him. It was about this sort of culture on some level. And Gingrich sort of like seems to have some of that. He almost like uses policy in the way that some people use culture. He just wants power. Like, how much insight do you have as to like what motivated him to become a congressman? Because it sort of feels like he wanted that idea of being an academic where he gets to tell, you know, talk to, you know, has an audience every day in terms of his class, but then he didn't want to do the work.
Yeah. I mean, he's until the mid 70s, even the first time he runs for the House seat, he's really a Rockefeller Republican. He's not particularly committed to, you know, a set of conservative ideas. He believes the Republican Party should be a broad coalition. He loved Nixon before Watergate because he thought that's exactly what Nixon was doing. And it's only in the mid-70s he starts to associate with the right-wing conservative movement that's taking form. Look, broadly, he does accept the importance of tax cuts and deregulation and a strong defense. But within that, he's pretty flexible. And I think even though we think of him as this big ideas politician and he likes to present himself that way, the professor politician, really, he's exactly what you're saying. He's about getting power for the Republican Party and figuring out how to do that. That's been his central theme throughout his career. Rather than as a fierce ideologue, the ideology, the policies, that's all in service of his partisan strategy.
And all right, so talk about that first election that he wins, because that seems to be largely a template for how he's going to do everything.
Yeah, he runs against someone named Virginia Shepherd, who is in the state government. And she's actually a moderate Democrat, more conservative than him on a lot of fiscal issues. So he needs to figure out in 1978 how to basically take her down. And at one moment, she says to a reporter that if she wins, she'll move to Washington and her family will stay in the district. Her husband had a job and she didn't see any need that he had to lose that. So Gingrich just picks up on that. He hones right in on that statement. And he says she's going to break up her family for her professional aspirations. And she's a radical because of this. And every campaign stop after that, he appears with his family surrounding him and makes himself the family values candidate as a way to remind voters of what he's saying about her. And it's a pretty brutal campaign. The Shepherd campaign people are just taken aback that he's doing this, but it works. He wins the seat.
And I mean that he's running, I mean, it becomes a template for the modern Republican Party in many respects, right? I mean, like they did that to Hillary Clinton shortly, you know, right. I don't know how many years later it was, I guess, 15 years later, that became the issue with Hillary Clinton, that she was, you know, not going to stay in the kitchen.
Well, yes, that's exactly right. And Gingrich is a storyteller. I mean, he believes that from the start, the way to win in politics is to tell the story that sticks in the media and to make of your opponents a caricature. And if it's well done, it's hard for them to undo, and that the media will suck it up if it's done in blistering fashion. And so he does that particular template with her, and he'll continue with Hillary Clinton. And then with Democrats, you know, he makes them into this corrupt establishment that has absolutely no intrinsic value and is lining its pockets. And he's very good at putting people into that portrait.
Let's talk about, okay, so he comes in 78. Of course, Ronald Reagan becomes elected in 1980. He goes on to basically set up, I don't know, with this, is it like the, were there a lot of caucuses before this? He sets up like basically like his, you know, a prototype, it seems like, for the Freedom Caucus in a way.
Yeah, caucuses are just taking form in the 70s, really. The Congressional Black Caucus is one of the first big ones. There's something called the Democratic Study Group. And they're just starting to sprout. And he creates his own, the Conservative Opportunity Society, which is a small group of Republicans like him who are as critical of their own leadership as they were the Democrats and were saying the party had to do anything, basically. They had to go there to win. And we have to remember the House of Representatives had been controlled by Democrats since 1954. So in their minds, unless the party was willing to be much more radical in its tactics, the GOP would forever be a minority party. So this group, the Congressional, the COS, as a shorthand, becomes his team. They are his allies. And through them, he starts to conduct his wars.
I mean, this is the thing that I think is really sort of fascinating, is that it is, again, it is structured around this idea of how to win as opposed to what to win.
That's true. I think that's really important in terms of understanding him. A lot of the story that I tell is about him focusing on ethics and why Democrats are unethical, including the Speaker of the House. While he's doing this, he is accused all the time of unethical behavior, and he's being investigated for it. He doesn't care deep down about a lot of the issues that he focuses on. They are a means to an end, and it's about the winning. And if there's a way to understand the Gingrich mentality through today in the GOP, it's partisanship above all else, including governance, including the needs of the institution. And you always make that the priority in what you're doing. And that also means a lot of your ideas and principles, they're flexible, and you'll move to the one that's more useful for you.
Hence burning down the house.
That's exactly right. A song that, you know, provides the perfect title. And that is what he wanted to do. He didn't believe there was an incremental way to defeat the Democrats. You had to take them down. And you also had to take down the institution as it operated. You had to change the basic rules of politics. And that's what he set out to do.
And so, okay. So one of his targets early on was actually, or I guess maybe the focus of his ire was a guy named Bob Michael, who was the, and people should, I should remind people, the Democrats controlled the House for about what, 40 some odd years more?
Yeah, since 1954. Straight.
So they controlled it from 54 until 95, I guess it was.
Yep.
And so people have to understand it in that context, that the, in many respects, the Democrats had ossified it, you know, as far as I can recall. And there was, you know, there was a real sort of like transactional quality to everything. Right. And there was a lot of like sort of good old boy quality to all of it, it seems to me. And Gingrich came in and he had a real problem with Bob Michael, who was the minority leader of the Republicans. I mean, is this like an anti-establishment thing, or is this more like, you know, I don't know, here's the new boss, same as the old boss type of situation?
Well, the anti-establishment rhetoric was something Gingrich, he's very deliberate about this, and he argues this is the rhetoric Republicans have to use. In the aftermath of Watergate and Vietnam, there's a lot of distrust in this country. A lot of it had been focused on Republicans, but he says, let's turn it on the Democrats. Let's use this as the main argument to go after the Democratic Party. And they had been in power so long. Everything you said is true. And so they were vulnerable. And he thought that was a much more effective kind of rhetoric than even liberal versus conservative, right versus left, establishment versus anti-establishment. almost capitalize on the ethos of the 60s and use it against the party of liberalism. But that also meant going after Republicans like Bob Michael, who were comfortable in the system, who believed still in the importance of governing and being able to make decisions and pass legislation. But he was going to have to change their way or even take them down eventually if his style was going to win. So he's known in the 80s as a guy who's just as dangerous to his own party as he is to the Democrats. And so I think, it's a tactic, but it's a tactic based on some truth that he sensed in how Washington worked.
You know, the notion of his anti-establishmentarianism, I guess, coming out of the 60s, that story about, what was it called? Cam Scam. Cam Scam reminded me of like something that Abby Hoffman would have done. You know what I mean? Like there was a yippie quality to that. I mean, obviously there's a lot of, but like just the ability of like, we're going to make the system work on itself. Like it reminded me in some way of like going into Wall Street and throwing cash everywhere. But just, tell us that story. Cause it's, I think it shows how media savvy and how much he knew, this was really about, how to tell a story.
Yeah, I mean, in 1984, he and this group, COS, they're trying to figure out a way to get known and get their message out. And then he says, you know, there's this channel called C-SPAN that had been created in 1979 when the House finally allowed cameras to cover what they were doing. It was a sunshine reform, throw light onto Washington. And what Gingrich and his allies do is they go on the floor at the end of every day when any member, even someone who doesn't have power, is allowed to make a short 1-minute speech. And they started making a speech every single day at the end of the day. And the speeches were blistering. They were attacking Democrats for being weak on defense, saying the whole party didn't really care about the security of this country. They weren't supporting Reagan's war against communism in Central America. And it got even worse as the speeches progressed. They started calling out specific Democrats and saying, is this all true about you? And why don't you respond? And if you were watching C-SPAN, you saw no one respond. It looked like the Democrats had zero answers to the charge. But what you couldn't see, because the camera only showed the person speaking, was that the chamber was 100% empty. There was no one there. And it was a kind of Abby Hoffman-like political theater, but carried out on a national stage on this new medium of cable television. And the story progresses. Speaker Tip O'Neill gets so mad, he comes in and he orders the cameras to show the chamber so that viewers could see this is all just not true. It's kind of a made-up situation. And even then, Gingrich turns it on him and he says, look at the speaker. He's violating the rules, which say you can't show the chamber. He's an autocrat. He's tyrannical. He kind of quickly uses that and gets that rhetoric out there. And then the whole thing ends with O'Neill making this blistering speech about Gingrich, saying this is McCarthyism. It's the lowest thing he's seen in Washington. And the Republicans actually are able to strike the speaker's words from the record and say they were inappropriate. And again, it showed just how far the Democrats are willing to go. And it all culminates with the networks covering this, meaning Gingrich, who is still pretty unknown, uses this Cam Scam incident, uses this controversy to get on the national networks, on national newspaper stories, and he had arrived. He gives them conflict, and the media can't resist. And that is something he does again and again and again.
And then within a couple of years, it's basically, you know, we get to in many respects the sort of the pivot point of your book, where he, not single-handedly, but he is the he basically goes after Jim Wright, who is he goes after Jim Wright, who is the Speaker of the House after Tip O'Neill steps down in 87. This is where he basically hones. And I, you know, I was in college at that time. I don't remember, you know, I vaguely remember all of it happening. I just wasn't as in, you know, wasn't paying as much attention at the time, but it struck me as how effective, because I'm quite convinced that although the Iraq War was a very big part of it, the Democrats took back the House in 2006 because of corruption. And the salience of corruption in that, talk about his attack on Jim Wright, but then also talk about this sort of like, you know, historically, has corruption always been this effective?
It is a big issue. I mean, this is a country which was founded not only about fears of centralized power, but also fears of corrupt power. So I think at some level it resonates. And that's how Gingrich then went after Jim Wright. Jim Wright was an old school Democrat. He had been majority leader for 10 years. He had been pretty tough with Republicans. He felt like he was fighting a last stand for liberalism, especially in the 1980s. So a lot of Republicans didn't like him so much. And there have been stories in the national and Texas press about Speaker Wright, about Jim Wright, about some relations he had with business people in his district that seemed a little shady. He had a book of speeches, a thin little book, but he would sell them in bulk whenever he spoke to big groups. And it was because you could only earn so much in speaking fees, but you could earn all you want as a legislator through book royalties. And what Gingrich did is he took these kinds of stories, which were, they didn't look good, but they weren't, you know, another Watergate. But he kept saying, this is the most corrupt speaker in American history. And he took bits and pieces of the stories and blew it up into a kind of scandal frenzy in Washington. Now, and ultimately, the House Ethics Committee starts an investigation and finds that there might be something there. They need to keep looking and look more seriously. But the pressure builds so badly before any investigation is done and completed, Wright will resign. And so he uses this fear of corruption, the ethical rules that were put into place after Watergate as a way to reform Washington, and the investigative journalism that was starting to come out also the post-Woodward and Bernstein era after Watergate. And he uses all this to, again, like in 78, draw a portrait of basically a criminal in the speaker seat. And it's pretty devastating.
All right. Let's talk about, though, the Democrats' reaction, like the way the Democrats handled this, because that dynamic where you have, and we should say, Newt Gingrich, every single thing that he accused Wright of doing or the that came up on ethics, he was doing himself, maybe more. Also, not to mention, you know, like we saw this with the impeachment on some level. So it is not just, it's not a question of there's an asymmetry in terms of like, you know, how dirty one party or the other was. But this, the way the Democrats reacted and the way the Republicans worked, that dynamic seems to have been like dipped in amber and has existed, it seems to me, up until, I'm going to say, like maybe 2018. I mean, like talk about their response, because I feel like this movie plays over and over again.
Absolutely. I mean, whenever you focus on an individual who has a big impact, you think about the reactions of the people he worked with. The reaction of Republicans in my book is the party leaders embrace him. And even though they say this guy's toxic, it's dangerous, he's a new Joe McCarthy, they say, well, let's let him in the doors and we'll work with him. The reaction of Democrats is simply not, they're kind of totally caught off guard. They don't know how to handle him. They don't know what he's up to in the media. They don't know how to really handle the fact that he's guilty of exactly what he's accusing Jim Wright of. Some would say even worse at the time this is all unfolding. I mean, within the months leading into Wright's resignation, there's an investigation, a newspaper report that Gingrich himself had an unethical book deal and he raised money from interest groups to promote the thing. And he has to have a press conference, several, about this. And, you know, Gingrich just says it's different, it's not relevant, and the Republicans stand by him. Democrats essentially give up right. They start to put pressure on him to step down. They start to whisper to the media, I think it's time for him to go. And so in terms of the resolve of the parties, there's a difference then that goes through today. And in terms of what they were willing to do, the Democrats are still more restrained in terms of even how they will go after Gingrich than Gingrich is about going after them. And the parties have not embraced the same kind of partisanship since that period. Maybe it's changing in 2018, but the party is much more checked as a whole than Republicans, who loved what Gingrich did. And they've said, let's just go all out, forget the guardrails, and let's tear things down. And it's an asymmetry through and through.
It's, I mean, is, from your perspective, is the asymmetry just a function of this dynamic where, you know, ultimately Democrats, you know, there's different sort of like ideologies, I think, within the Democratic Party, but ultimately they all want government to work in some fashion, and conservatives, Republicans, they are happy to have the destruction of government because it's always an impediment, you know, on some level to their interests. Is that the only asymmetry?
I think that's the most important one. I mean, the point of the Gingrich story, and certainly someone will probably write it about President Trump, is that when you let partisanship run free and when you avoid or eliminate any kind of countervailing thoughts that a politician has, such as, I also have to be able to govern, I need to make sure the institutional working and isn't destroyed. When you put those totally aside and you let partisanship run amok, the threat is that government becomes dysfunctional. And you have two parties with two different philosophies. Democrats, center and left, still all at some level believe in the importance of government, the value of government, and government as a first line in dealing with some of the problems we face as a society. So you can't ultimately embrace a level of partisanship will destroy the ability of that government to work. But Republicans are fine with that, especially as the Republicans have moved rightward. Dysfunction fulfills everything they say about government. Doesn't work. It's not useful. And so I think that's part of why the parties are different. And then part of it, kind of the impact of leaders from Gingrich to Trump, they have also legitimate that kind of thinking within their party.
I agree. I think that is a big tenet, but I can't help for instance, in fact, today, Joe Biden has come out and said, I'm open to getting rid of the filibuster for legislation, right? Chris Coons said it a couple of weeks ago, which I think was which was basically tipping the hand. Chris Coons is, you know, as you know, Biden's one of his top surrogates, maybe his only surrogate. I don't know. And he signaled that he did. Now he signaled that he did. He was open to it because it wasn't Bernie Sanders as the nominee, right? Like, I mean, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, Chris Coons still thinks that as an institutionalist, we need to keep the filibuster here. So I wonder, and I know this is a little bit outside of the scope of your book, but you've written a lot of books about Democrats as well, or a lot about Democrats, I should say. Isn't there also some notion of like the relationship between the bases that is different between the parties? You know, Chris Coons wants to keep the filibuster if he is equally afraid of, and maybe more so afraid of, what the left flank of the Democratic Party is going to do without it than he is with what the Republicans will do without it.
Well, I think what you're saying at some level is that in the GOP, the base now controls the party. And this is also part of the story of the last four decades, where the Republicans move much more, not only sharply to the right than Democrats do to the left, but as a whole, they move together. There's just much less division. Democrats are still much more of a divided party, even in this partisan age. And so then some of these tactical considerations are going to be different. And That's exactly what you're arguing with Coons, with Sanders. Those divisions just are not really as much of a factor. Everyone's on board in the GOP with Trump, with Mark Meadows, now chief of staff, before the head of the Freedom Caucus. And when you don't have those divisions, when you are truly party united, I think you're willing to move much farther and take bigger risks than you are if you're still divided.
And the amazing thing is, I think the Republican Party is united simply around power. I mean, I know like this is a, you know, to say that about a political party is incredibly hackneyed. It's said every day on right-wing radio. And, but I mean, Mark Meadows was, like you say, a Freedom Caucus guy, and he has presided over, or, you know, at least he's been there for a couple of months. Anyways, he's joined an administration that is, you know, I have no problem with them spending. I think they should spend more. But they threatened out to shut down the government because of what now amounts to a minuscule deficit relative to what it is now. Like, there doesn't seem to be a single principle that they have maintained other than, you know, destruction of government and maybe at the behest of wealthy people.
Well said, and a fair point. I mean, I think there are certain threads you could probably see in the party. One is a supply side approach to all economic policy, and I think a general attack on the social safety net. And now you could argue white backlash politics is becoming pretty integral to what the party is about. But outside of that, I think the principles are hard to see. They are Gingrich-like in that they are forms of rhetoric rather than genuine policy preferences, fiscal conservatism, family values, all of that you'll hear again and again going into 2020, but it doesn't really match a lot of what the party is about. And that is related to a party where partisanship is the guiding principle. And if you have that principle, not only are you willing to threaten the institutions of our democracy, you're also willing to go against what you're promising to voters with great ease, with amazing ease, because you're not committed to that. You're committed to holding the reins of power.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, GOPAC. And this is sort of after Gingrich gets his big scalp. And in the early 90s, he forms this PAC, and I'm really interested in his relationship with Frank Luntz, where that leads to, and also his relationship with talk radio, which really begins to explode after the Fairness Doctrine. Reagan kills the Fairness Doctrine, and you start to see it really grow. I mean, Limbaugh comes on the scene, I think it was in 88-ish. Talk about that, because he immediately realizes the value of that. And then we should probably also throw in Atwater, because in some ways Atwater learns from Gingrich as much as Gingrich learns from Atwater, it feels like.
True. So GOPAC's actually created in the early 80s, and Gingrich takes it over from DuPont in 1984. It's a defunct organization, and Gingrich turns it into a real important part of his platform. It's basically a way to communicate with other Republican candidates. He sends out videos. He sends out memos about what to say, what to do in front of the media. And when he starts teaming up with Frank Luntz, they start really perfecting suggestions about rhetoric. And just as a taste, they let one out in 1990, which goes to Republican candidates running in the midterms. And the memo, it's one of the most famous. It's called Language, a Key Mechanism of Control. And it says, if you're a Republican who thinks, I wish I could speak like Newt, they say you have to use the following words to talk about Democrats: corruption, traitors, sick, radical, shame, pathetic, steal, and lie. And that's a flavor of what he did with this. And ultimately, GOPAC will bring him into ethical trouble because he uses it for his own campaign. He becomes the first speaker in American history who is reprimanded and fined for ethics violations, ironically enough. The talk radio is also important. He's at the forefront of talk radio, and it's just growing. Important to remember, he precedes really the growth of conservative talk radio. And a lot of what you hear on the airwaves is very Gingrich-like. But when he's speaker in 94 or 95, he works closely with Rush, and they actually focus on messaging and themes of the day. And the Republican leadership and a lot of conservative talk radio hosts work hand in hand in a way which we see with Fox News all the time. But Lee Atwater, finally, is also part of this same world. And one moment in my story is 1988. When George H.W. Bush is starting his campaign, he's the epitome of the old guard civil Republican. But Lee Atwater, who's a South Carolinian, really fierce campaigner who loves wrestling and thinks politics is like wrestling, he starts to introduce Gingrich's attacks on Jim Wright into the campaign. And Bush starts to talk about them before much of Washington thinks this is acceptable. And the Atwater-Gingrich relation is about how the party leaders and the maverick political bomb throwers, you know, merged together by 1988 and 1989. So all of this is a huge infrastructure of Republican politics, the media, the campaigns, the congressional politics that I think really created the foundation of the current presidency.
And you do open the book up with Gingrich being essentially vetted for the vice presidency. I just want to touch also on this on the Contract for America, because that was a document. I'm seeing this like as a strategy now, and it really becomes clear to me. In the context of the Lincoln Project, actually, you know, you see like the Lincoln Project is out there doing these ads. They're the Never Trumpers. They're Republicans who are espousing, telling Republicans not to vote for Trump, but rather vote for Biden. I am very skeptical as to their efficacy in terms of changing anybody's minds for votes, but they seem to be very effective in making it seem like they're changing people's minds for votes, and that the value of what they're doing to them has more to do after the fact, so that they can claim part of the mandate if Joe Biden gets one. And it feels like that's what the Contract of America for America or with America was about too. That came in late. Nobody voted. Nobody came and pulled the lever for Republicans because of the Contract for America. Barely people were even aware of it before the election, were they?
No, it was really a campaign ploy. It was done at the end. I think it was really targeting the media rather than the voters. It was distributed. This is a contract which listed a set of principles Republicans promised to put into place if they won. It was a way to almost nationalize the election and compete with Bill Clinton. And it was put out in TV Guide, and it was a tear out sheet that voters were able to put on their refrigerator as a reminder for what Republicans would do. But the real target were reporters. It was a way to get attention for what Republicans were about, to get coverage of this story. They appear on Capitol Hill with the Contract of America and get some good stories out of that. And I think that's ultimately what it was. None of it ever comes into being. And so once again, I think it reflects some of the thinness of some of the promises that are made in this era.
All right. So talk about his Gingrich's ultimate fall. He is really just disliked by a lot of people. And when he becomes less effective, he's summarily booted.
Yes. So he leads the impeachment against Bill Clinton. The House is getting ready to vote on the impeachment, which revolves around Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky.
We should also say it's necessary to say that Newt Gingrich, not necessarily the guy you would imagine who is best suited to carry a message of you shouldn't lie about sex.
Well, that's what happens. I mean, in the 98 midterms, which take place right before the vote, the Republicans do poorly, so they're already angry with him. because he's not delivering the numbers he's promising on the Hill. But second, he's having an affair. And here's the leader of the party going after the president, who's himself, and this wasn't the first. So he didn't embody at all the values that the party was espousing, and the party couldn't afford that anymore. In fact, the person who's first going to replace Newt Gingrich is Robert Livingston of Louisiana, who voluntarily steps down from this job before he gets it, because he's also in a relationship. And then, of course, the next speaker is Denny Hastert, whose family values are anything but, as we know from his faith.
Right. Yeah. The guy was a pedophile and was, yeah, was preying on wrestlers. I mean, yeah, he was a coach. He was a wrestling coach. I don't know why that keeps coming up. And that also seems to be a Republican theme. Jim Jordan, at the very least, didn't necessarily participate, but certainly as a coach was not protecting his players. That's according to the players. I don't know if we could believe them, but I would imagine that many of them wouldn't lie about it. But Gingrich goes down in flames, and then he just sort of maintains his grift for really through the beginning of Trump. He seems to have, is he not around as much, or am I just not watching as much right wing TV?
He has a few years where he's not around as much, and he focuses on his consulting business, and he makes a lot of money, but he does return. He returns first in that conservative world. He's a big presence on Fox television. He likes to present himself as the conservative intellectual and really takes on that role. But then he runs for president in 2012. And Kellyanne Conway actually helps run his campaign. And he starts the theme again of conservative populism. He goes after Mitt Romney for his work at Bain Capital, but he loses. And then he comes back a few years later as one of the vice presidential finalists for the Trump ticket, and ultimately loses out to Mike Pence.
So are we done with that era? I mean, do you think that, like, I mean, because if it does feel like Gingrich's influence, I mean, in terms of the, let's put it this way, like the Republican Party, I think, is still on a Gingrich trajectory, right? Where it's just like, and I think you can see that both in terms of the elected officials, but you can see it with like the huge cadre of money that just flows into the right, where it's, there are no principles. It's just about, you know, winning on some effect and measured either with clicks or views or book sales or, you know, elections or gerrymandering or judges. But it feels like the Democrats are exiting the Gingrich era before the Republicans are.
Democrats definitely are. I think you see a true generational change that's happening in the party. In 2018 was the first time you really saw it play out in the electoral realm, with Democrats who, in terms of their views, are just in a very different place than their predecessors. But many Democrats who've grown up watching this Gingrich Republican Party. And I think that's part of why they're very sensitive to the need to be a lot tougher and more sophisticated in competing with them. I don't know with Republicans. I mean, look, the person everyone's now talking about as the next in line is Tucker Carlson. So that would suggest that the next generation might be just as committed to this one, for this form of politics. And I don't know. It's a shrinking party. It has a shrinking base. It has a president who's definitely not helping them expand it. But they still have things like the Electoral College. And I guess the question in 2020, 2024 is, does this all finally come back to bite the party? And do we enter a new era? I don't know the answer to that. But I think what you're touching on is the big question for the GOP.
All right. Lastly, let me ask you, this is not related to the book, but you're a historian. And I know you're not supposed to do this, but how are historians going to look at this era? Are there eras that you look back in American history and just say, boy, those people, I mean, laughable, must have been a nightmare being there, but they were horrible. Like, where do you think we're going to fit in that context? presuming, of course, that we can, you know, save civilization from global climate change.
Yeah, look, I think the period leading into the Civil War certainly is just one study after another of failed leadership, of dysfunctional politics, and of the inability of elected officials to resolve the biggest problem of our time, slavery. Now, I think it's going to be an era of just total dysfunction and breakdown. And I think as a historian, it's not going to be that we're looking at both parties the same way. That just would be inaccurate. I think one of the big puzzles will be starting with Donald Trump and looking backwards and saying, how did we get to this place? How did we get to a moment where this is what you see from the presidency? And this is a party that is generally fine with that. And that's going to be one of the biggest questions, as well as the cost, the dysfunction that resulted from it, which we see playing out right now in the pandemic.
Well, I certainly hope they start with Donald Trump, because if they start with Tom Cotton, we're in big, big trouble. Julian Zelizer, the book is Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of the Speaker, The Rise of the New Republican Party. We'll put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it as well.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program. I will be joined by Nomiki Konst. In fact, she's joining us in just a moment. I can see the Matriarch Pack logo on her Zoom.
It's not supposed to.
Oh, maybe I forget that. Yeah, there we go.
I signed in the wrong account.
But you still have the logo up there. Now I see your name, but it's also...
Wait, there I am.
There you go.
Voila.
Well, look at that. New backdrop.
I know, not as fancy.
I don't know. I like that one. It is... I like that. I like it.
I should have, like, I saved all that money and just did it from my living room?
No, I don't know. I mean, it cuts both ways. You do need some sound deadening in there, but we can talk about that later.
And, okay. I have to move my microphone over.
No, you're good. You're good. Okay. Well, I should remind people, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Oh, and we should also, you know what, let's play this clip as a way of reminding people about our merch shop. This is fascinating. You know, we have, Nomi, as you know, we have a merch shop at shop.majorityreportradio.com. And, we have different merchandise there. We have a new shirt, a limited edition shirt that we've laid out. But wait a second. Let's play this clip. Have you seen this clip? Because this reminded me a little bit of what we're trying to do. They apparently have taken a mummy.
Oh, my God.
And they have been able to put it through an MRI to get a notion of what the sound box sounded like. And so check this out. This is really crazy.
Scientists were able to mimic Nessie Amun's voice by recreating his mouth and vocal cords with a 3D printer. It allowed them to produce a single sound.
I'm losing it, bro.
It's the I'm losing it, bro. Sounds almost identical. Wait, no, not to that.
I'm losing it, bro.
It sounds almost identical to John Benjamin's sound drop that we use as the basis of a shirt. All proceeds go to skidrow.org, Skid Row Trust in LA, to help with unhoused folks. And it's just, I'm blown away by the coincidence. A lot of people are claiming that we stole it from
the mummy,
but I can assure you that is not the case. But people can go and buy all sorts of stuff at our merch shop. And of course, sign up for the AM Quickie. And don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Tonight is Tuesday night. The Michael Brooks Show happens every Tuesday night. You can check it out at patreon.com/TMBS or youtube.com/TMBS. Who's on tonight, Matt?
Tonight, we have Robert McChesney on Corporate Monopolies and Media Present and History.
Yeah, McChesney is a professor, I believe, at University of Madison. University of Wisconsin, Madison. who's been writing about this stuff for a long time. Great guest. So check that out. And Nomi, what's happening on your show?
I have Kate Bricolet from the Daily Beast talking about Ghislaine Maxwell. She's been following her case for, you know, I don't know, last year or so. And Matt Stoller is debunking the myths of Hamilton and how we all pretend to love him, but he's really a horrible.
Hates Hamilton.
So do I.
I mean, for me, it's just like my kids sing it all the time. I've never seen it, but
I have. Yeah,
my kids.
Well, there's a story. I don't want to give it all away, but the basis of why it's being mythologized, a lot of it actually has roots in New York politics. Lin-Manuel Miranda's father is a very powerful political consultant here in New York who represents the bondholders in Puerto Rico and helped get Tom Perez elected as chair of the DNC. So all things are connected.
Wow, and I know that Stoller's got a real problem with the finances, the financier bent of Hamilton. That's interesting. When's that going up, and where can people find it?
The full show went up on yesterday on Monday on YouTube / The Nomi Key Show, and it'll be released in chunks. It's also on Patreon.com/ The Nomi Key Show. We also have swag. Ha ha.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Three things: stickers, mugs, and totes.
How did you do that so quick? I thought you had to wait 10 years before you had merch.
I'm a hustler, Sam. I'm a hustler.
I know. I'm very, very slow. Matt, what's happening on... also, folks, don't forget to check out The Antifada. Find that at patreon.com/TheAntifada. And I think this is the week that Jamie's going to be on the Socialist Conference. More info, check out the blog for that. Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Twitch.tv/literary hangover. I'll probably be streaming tomorrow night.
All right. Well, that sounds okay. Not really. That's soft sell. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun hat, 646-257-3920. You can also IM the show with the use of our app at majorityapp.com. Back in a second.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.